Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And I'm George.
And this is a budget special edition of the New Statesman podcast. Yes, it is all budget all the time. We've got so much to chew over after yesterday's statement from George Osborne in the House and Labour's response to it. We took some questions as well, but there's probably no logical order to do this in. But let's do it in terms of headline grabbing ones first. Should we care about the sugar tax? Is it A, terrible imposition of the nanny state, or B, sensible public health intervention? George, discuss.
I think it is largely sensible, because if it fails to stop people buying sugary drinks, you've got money raised for investment in school sports. I think it was a smart political act to hypothecate the revenue, so it's not just going into the treasury, into a black hole. It's clear what it's going to be spent on.
And it's being spent on school sports, right?
Yes, at primary level. And of course, if it does stop people buying them, there's a question of where the sports funding is going to come from. But the Treasury were yesterday saying that would be a good problem to have. And I think actually, in some ways, it was quite a significant move, because Osborne had quite a moral section of his speech where he sounded quite emotive and said, you know, I would feel I'd let future generations down if I looked back on my time in Parliament and we did nothing.
I quite like the bit about the five-year-old who eats their own body weight in sugar every year. And I mostly just thought about how delicious, a pile of sugar. Stephen, as we know, George drinks only green tea and eats only dry toast. I've seen Goody Bush drinking Coke, full fat Coke, at his desk. Are you upset about that extra 8p that's going to be on that can of Coke?
No, I'm actually hugely pro this. I mean, it's something that Andy Burnham was campaigning for as Secretary of State for Health. It's why the tabloids briefly branded him the serial killer. It's been the central plank of Liz Kendall's entire political career. When she was a special advisor in health, she was one of the people behind the smoking ban, behind all of that public health stuff. And it's something Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott have been campaigning on since Diane Abbott got into Parliament in 1987.
Labour don't seem to be getting an enormous amount of credit for it, though.
Yeah, I think they really ought to have done. I mean, it's always difficult when the other people steal your show, and he had a very good but clearly pre-prepared stump speech, and responding to the budget is the most difficult thing the Leader of the Opposition has to do. But obviously, I'm allowed to make it look like it's really easy, so I'm just going to go, well, what he should have done is gone, thank you for adopting our policy, and done a little victory lap. But yeah, it will be regressive, it will take money from the poor disproportionately, but obesity takes years from the poor disproportionately, so
I think for me it was one of those things where I find it very odd to see people on the kind of libertarian right suddenly very upset about the idea that poor people can't do things because they've got less money than rich people. Because there are lots of things that poor people can't do, you know, they find it harder to travel, they find it harder to go on holiday, they find it harder to do, you know, to retire early. Like you say, they find it, you know, it's correlated with lower life expectancy. And then to sort of suddenly dress up your concern about higher taxes generally in a kind of cloak of suddenly this is the point moment you've discovered that actually it's quite hard to be on a low income, I found slightly tasteless. Let's move on, though, because George, I was really interested. I mean, the sugar tax was the kind of, it was the rabbit, to use our awful, unbearable terminology. It was the in-speech rabbit. The pre-speech rabbit was this idea that all schools now in England and Wales are going to, oh, is it Wales? Hang a minute.
It's just England.
It's just
Education
England.
Is devolved in Wales.
Yeah, okay, so and we already know that Scotland was. So schools in England, both primaries and secondaries, are all going to become academies. Can you talk us through what that means?
Yes, so what it means is that those schools which continue to have local authority supervision, it's not complete control, will become academies, which means that they have autonomy over, for instance, parts of the curriculum, over teachers' pay, over teachers' hours. And this obviously is the fulfillment of sort of a long-standing government aim, which is to move all schools to that status. And the program, of course, began under Tony Blair and Labour as a means of revitalising underperforming inner-city schools. Under Michael Gove, it was dramatically accelerated. And there is a question mark over whether this is affordable and whether this is desirable, because although there's some academy chains which perform above average, there are others which don't. And it does appear as if this is being driven by ideology and by the desire to secure headlines than by policy and evidence.
One of the things I find most interesting about it is this: it creates this whole tier of people, these schools commissioners, who now have an enormous amount of power, but themselves have only oversight from the Secretary of State. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, obviously saying this is a revolution, it's putting more power into the hands of parents, but it's quite difficult if you're a parent and you complain to, say, the headmaster or the headmistress of your academy. They complain to the, you know, the next tier up is probably like the CEO of the chain. The next person up to complain to is now no longer your local council. It is Nicky Morgan, and you're kind of like, I'm imagining that Nicky Morgan's probably not going to spend a lot of her time answering letters from people who are, you know, upset about something that's happening in their school.
And the DfE, like almost every central department, doesn't have a particularly large staff, and its staff has got smaller since 2010. And of the 36 academy chains, I think it's 36, it may be more than that now, only three of them overperform in terms of value added, so not just when you have bright kids who continue to, you know, like, and kids from higher income backgrounds who continue to do well, but, you know, when you're actually driving up results. Harris Academy chain, ARC schools, and the Diocese of Westminster. So there's a real question about whether or not there is enough capacity, even before you get into the problem, which you're entirely right, and there is just not an oversight structure. But the form of words Osborne used was quite interesting. He said, by 2020, they will be moving towards. Well, I mean, Osborne has been moving towards closing the deficit for 6 years now.
Exactly. I'm moving towards my career as a supermodel, but it's, you know, it's taking a long time to materialise. I think the other thing that's really interesting that we don't, it's very hard to talk about, is the fact that although people, the idea of introducing profit into the schools is kind of one of those trigger words that just instantly kind of freaks people out, like the NHS. But there are things already that are happening in schools that are introducing profit. So, for example, it is perfectly legitimate for you to set up an academy chain, write your own curriculum, and sell that curriculum to schools, back into your schools. And that is what some people are doing. So there are people making money now out of education, without really kind of anybody having tweaked that's what's happened. Mm. And certainly, George, I think that this kind of move does make it easier to move towards for-profit schools if you ever decide you want to do that in, you know, another government, right?
It does. And of course, they have them in Sweden, which was the inspiration for the free schools program. And there are people in the Conservative Party who have always argued that philosophically, what George Osborne's arguing doesn't make sense unless you allow sort of for-profit schools. And to link it back to the sugar debate, of course, academies, I think, are exempt from rules on nutrition and school lunches. And they do have more unhealthy goods for sale. So there's an interesting tension there between the government's intervention on the one hand with the sugar levy on companies, but also on academies, a more libertarian approach where you actually have fewer regulations that schools have to follow.
Okay, let's move on, because I think there were a couple of things in the budget that we almost didn't notice, I guess, because of everything else that's happened. I read a piece this morning by Fraser Nelson in The Spectator saying, you know, this was a budget that sort of, you know, people in the Tory shires are going to think is almost socialist, you know, that this is a something that Gordon Brown could have delivered. And I kind of sort of thought, is it really early in the morning and I'm on glue, or are you on glue? And the thing I thought was, you know, the idea that a budget in which corporation tax is cut by 8 points is, you know, to an incredibly low level. The, you know, budget in which, I think you were saying this morning, George, it's the rise in the threshold for the upper, for 40p tax from sort of around 42 to 45,000 a year is the biggest hike since, what, the 80s?
Yes, it is, since the 80s. Yes, since Nigel Lawson introduced the 40p rate.
So there's red meat. It's not namby-pamby kind of, you know, new
exactly.
Labour line.
It's a very redistributive budget, but in the opposite direction to Labour. Under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, Labour made huge efforts to redistribute large amounts of money from the affluent middle classes and upper classes to the less well-off through tax credits and through a more redistributive tax system. And they often did it by stealth. But now Osborne's I think Osborne's budget has become steadily more regressive as some of the progressive tax elements that were introduced, that they inherited from the last Labour government, and that the Lib Dems forced on them and the coalition have been discarded. So capital gains tax now has been cut from 28% back to 20%.
And you can tell that, I mean, one of the really sort of sinister elements in this budget round is that the government is now abolishing doing a distributional analysis of the impact of its tax and spending measures.
So this is the idea that they have to publish every time, you know, all of overall everything, like, and they divide it with like quintiles or deciles for every sort of 10 per part of, and so you can say, well, actually the measures in this budget fall most harshly on the richest 10%, right? Yeah. So they're not going to do that anymore.
They're only going to do it in terms of their tax decisions, because their argument is, oh, well, spending doesn't count because that's implying that spending won't reappear magically in the economy somewhere else.
There was an amazing bit on the Today programme interview with Osborne this morning where they said, well, you've missed your deficit target. These are targets you created and you said they were really important and you've missed them. And he said, yes, but I was the one who got the OBR to tell everyone that I was wrong and I'd done it. And I was like, I don't think you get credits for having given us the means to find out that you're wrong. But I guess in that case, he's definitely given with one hand and taken away with the other. Because those distribution impacts have been the thing that have allowed you to go, hang on a minute, this is actually a really great budget for upper middle class and and top earners. Let's move on slightly to Labour's response. Because, George, when you were saying that, I was having a sort of minor conniption. Because this is one of the things that gets me when I have arguments on Twitter, which I know I should give up for my benefit of my own blood. It'd be like sugar tax. It'd be the best thing for my blood pressure. But when people sort of say, well, even someone like the policies of Liz Kendall, there's no difference between her and the Tories. I just don't feel that even under Liz Kendall, led Labour Party, that you would have seen a budget like this. And it sort of makes me think that perhaps people have forgotten about what the Tories, you know, what their ideological kind of convictions are and what they do in office, that they would think that any Labour Chancellor would have stood up and given that budget.
Yes, absolutely. I think if this had been a budget delivered with Liz Kendall as leader, I'd say, and Shadow Chancellor, they would have reversed the big tax cut that's been given to on inheritance tax. They would have invested more in universal childcare. They would have invested more in tax credits and other benefits for the low paid. They certainly wouldn't have cut $4.4 billion from disability benefits, the personal independence payments, which, as I think Yvette Cooper was the first to spot this, that is the biggest revenue raiser over the fiscal period. That's a cut to the disabled, which was not promised in the Conservative manifesto. And in fact, David Cameron and George Osborne went out of their way to give the impression that they were only going to take benefits from, you know, the work shy, from the unemployed, not from the disabled.
Well, that's what annoys me about that, because the personal independence payment is what used to be disability living allowance. And we had a piece by Francis Ryan, who blogged on us for a lot about this, about how many of our Paralympians for 2012 relied on DLA in order to, for example, like have their car adapted so that they could drive to training, or, you know, have, you know, some bits of their house adapted. The whole point of personal independence payment, as the name suggests, is that it is for people to be able to do more with their lives, including working, than they would otherwise be able to do without any kind of assistance. Mm. And that seems to be, like you're saying, it's not even if you're going to accept that premise that everybody who's claiming disability allowances is just using them to sit around. This is a benefit that was specifically about getting people more active, more involved in their communities, more able to work, more able to do things.
And also, the really sinister thing here is, and so sometimes the Tories will do things that I disagree with because I think they're wrong, but there is at least a case. They know on this one that they are completely in the wrong, because they tried to do this in reverse 2 years ago, where they tried to say that, oh, if you had a guide dog, not a walking stick, then you were less blind and you therefore needed less money. And then Guide Dogs for the Blind sort of went into full on, if you do this, because obviously the great British public is not that fussed about people who claim any form of social security, but is really,
loves
animals. Yeah. And they said, you know, if you do this, people are going to have to give up their dogs.
People have to kill their dogs.
And so this is exactly the same policy lever. It's exactly the same revenue raiser, except they've completely changed all of the things they've decided do not make you as disabled. So it has no basis in evidence, no basis in the needs of people. It is just about finding $4.4 billion so they can have this ridiculous threshold raise for people who are in the top 15% of earners.
This is the thing I find really worrying about it, is that trying to find a way to critique that without just sounding like you are oppositional about everything. But I think that what's happened to disability benefit cuts have been really dismaying in the over the last 5 and a bit years. And the same things with, you know, those massive, massive cuts to council budgets and the direct grant that they get from the government. So much of that went to adult social care. And the problem with cutting that is that it affects a very small, well, relatively small, I mean, this benefit will, I think, cut will affect 600,000 people, which, you know, isn't nothing, but it isn't the same as tax credits would have, for example. You're affecting a smaller number of people in a way that absolutely completely shrinks the horizons of their life in a really unpleasant way. The same thing with adult social care cuts. You know, these are people who just need help to get up and get washed and get dressed, and they're getting much shorter carers visits as a result. It's also, again, I think, a betrayal of kind of the idea of if you believe in capitalism and markets, because what you're doing essentially is creating a whole load of extra unpaid work that has to be done by people, primarily by women. 75% of people who claim the carers allowance are women. But, you know, lots of these people who need help, the only people now will be able to do it will be their extended families, because they can't. And that means another class of people who are trying to juggle that on top of their paid work, trying to make those sums add up. And I think that's what's so alarming to me about it, is that by definition, the people who are affected by this find it very hard to organise and campaign, because they fundamentally find it quite hard to find any spare time or to get out of the house. So I'm kind of angry. George, what out of this budget are Labour opposing, and what have they said? You know, fair enough, we'll let that one go.
So they oppose the big cut in corporation tax, which is going to fall to a rate of just 17%. In 2020. It's worth noting that's 22 percentage points below the US headline rate.
So this is, I mucked this up before, didn't I? It's the difference in corporation tax rate, which has been cut, but capital gains tax has been cut even more.
Yes, although actually on the other hand, they have made some changes to the corporate tax regime on the treatment of profits, for instance, and other areas, which I think will mean that overall corporations are actually paying slightly more. And quite conveniently for Osborne, he's bringing in a lot of these changes in 2019-20, when he needs to achieve his surplus. And there's this completely incredible, unrealistic, impossible, absurd projected transformation where the country goes from a deficit of around 24 billion to a surplus of 10 billion in 1 year, which just isn't going to happen. And of course, that's something Labour oppose. They say, look, forget trying to achieve a budget surplus, which looks increasingly impossible. And that's even if we don't have a recession, and historic data suggests that the next recession is closer than the last one. Borrow for investments, as John McDonnell has been arguing, and as Rachel Reeves has sensibly suggested, a simple accounting change that Osborne would be to separate investment spending from day-to-day spending, for instance, on public sector salaries, so that the two are clearly separated. You can still say we're running a surplus on day-to-day spending, but on those areas of spending which independent bodies have said will pay dividends in the future, which will increase the long-term growth capacity of the economy, we will borrow for those, and we'll make that clear in the books.
So John McDonnell has given, you know, he's been around doing briefings and stuff this morning. What's their line on the raising of the 40p rate? Do we know anything about whether or not they're going to
oppose that? Looks as if they've accepted it. I think because presumably they feel that they don't want to get in a position where they're in favour of raising taxes on anyone but the very wealthy. Now, of course,
I don't mean to be rude, but sort of at that point, what's the point of being an anti-austerity? Like, that was what Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell were elected on. I mean, above anything else that people wanted from them, they wanted them to make those economic arguments, even if they're really unpopular and deemed to be, you know, not the kind of thing that wins you elections. But strange.
I think the difference is, I think the kind of divide is slightly too strong, but the slight difference of emphasis between Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell is that John McDonnell genuinely believes that they have a moment where they can win an election on this, on a prospectus significantly to the left of something Labour has ever been elected on before. But he also thinks, and if you go into an election promising a tax hike, you will be destroyed.
Why doesn't he just join the Tories, though, Stephen?
I mean, that is a view. Of course, it also partly comes down to the big economic project, which, you know, the sort of key guru of is a guy called John Ross, who is currently at the University of Beijing, and the Socialist Economic Bulletin. And their big economic idea is an investment in the economy is too low. You need more spending infrastructure, even if you're running a deficit, even, you know, that what really matters is you need to get your big transport projects, your big infrastructure. It's one of the reasons why Ross is such a big fan of the Chinese approach to the economy, where obviously they always have these big infrastructure projects pumping more output into the economy.
That does sound like that's quite, I mean, ironically, given that George Osborne is a big fan of Chinese investment, yeah, that does sound like that is gifting them quite a brilliant, you know, we've got a long-term economic plan, the Shadow Chancellor wants a five-year plan.
Yeah. But the rate of tax is actually not, in terms of what we might call, you might call it Corbynism, but in terms of its intellectual firepower, it's much more accurate to call it McDonaldism. The personal rate of tax is not really, it's marginal. It's something that they can throw away and still keep the big thing that they want, which is this.
But I find that really interesting, because that does sort of, when we talked about this before on the podcast, about this kind of emerging dynamic between Corbyn and McDonnell, and the fact that, you know, that Jeremy Corbyn is more content to be somebody who is for all the right things against all the bad things. John McDonnell does seem to have the scent in his nostrils about, you know, there are things that I'm willing to throw overboard in if we could possibly have a sniff of power, right? Is at any point that going to become a problem for all the people who felt very idealistic about Labour in the summer, George?
I think most of the time they get away with it on the Nixon goes to China principle. That it was quite notable that some predicted after John McDonnell's speech, in which he said, promised iron discipline and said we need to run a surplus on current spending, day-to-day spending.
There's nothing progressive about a deficit.
Yes, all of lines which, as Liz Kendall rightly pointed out, she used during her leadership campaign, there wasn't a big backlash, partly because he coupled it with saying we will borrow for investment, and also I want to transform the economy and restructure it. I want to create new forms of public ownership and community ownership. So that's my priority. So I think when you're perceived to be as left-wing as John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn are, you can actually get away with deploying rhetoric and policies of that kind. Similarly, when Liz Kendall actually proposed some quite left-wing policies during her leadership campaign, saying I'd reverse the inheritance tax cut, I'd invest and achieve universal childcare, I'd scrap the trade union bill and actually probably give them greater rights, no one accused her of being too left-wing or of abandoning the centre because she had because of her other positions.
I want to finish up finally just by talking about the tampon tax, which is a sort of personal obsession of mine. Actually, the charity that I chair applied for funds under it and didn't get any, so I should probably declare that interest on it. I think that's one where, on the Today programme interview this morning, Osborne was kind of going, well, we'll have to wait in a few days to see what the EU might say, which suggests to me that he might have been hoping for an EU-wide ruling. I'd like to remind people that Gordon Brown was the one who cut it from luxury rate, but he was too embarrassed to say the word tampon, and so therefore Dawn Primorolo had to announce it. Weird now to get a situation where you get John Humphreys merrily talking about tampons at 8:10 in the morning with George Osborne. I never really thought I'd live to see that. But I think that if they don't get that EU-wide ruling, there is actually a small problem, a little mini bump coming up for Osborne on that. Because the reason they can't zero rate sanitary products is down to the fact that it would have to be an EU-wide decision. So if Paul the Sheriff brings this, into and tries to put an amendment forward to say, she's essentially demonstrating that, you know, the Chancellor of the Exchequer does not have control over, you know, fully control over British tax policy in the run-up to an EU referendum. And I wonder whether or not something that seemed like an incredibly insignificant thing could actually become a potent weapon for Eurosceptics.
I mean, theoretically, but the problem is the kind of most of the people who are the face of the Leave campaign, with the exception of the incredibly impressive Gisela Stewart, are the kind of people who wouldn't say the word tampon in mixed company, or probably even in the privacy of their own homes. I mean, can you imagine Chris Grayling saying the word tampon?
Yeah.
It defies imagination, doesn't it? But it is, I think, a dangerous moment for the government, and they could expose their weakness. Although, to be honest, they probably could zero rate it. Unilaterally, no, I can't work out who would sue them. Like, you know, who's going to take them to the European Court of Justice to insist on the 5% being added on onto that.
Yeah, I do think it's one of those things with Europe where you probably could just, I mean, I sort of imagine that lots of, you know, the Italian government sort of sometimes just goes, nope, not going to do that. And they kind of get away with it. And we could probably just do the same.
Yeah, but it does mean instead we're going to have the slightly weird kind of classic of the Cameron era, which is then everyone in Europe is like, our currency, our borders. And he's like, so there's this small thing that I really could have got in a more subtle way, but I'd really like to make a big song and dance of it.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
let me talk to you about the menstrual cycle. And I imagine the European leaders will look at him very askance. I also think it's very odd if you look at the list of places the money has gone. Women's Campaign has been complaining there's no sexual violence charities on there. There are a lot of interesting schemes being supported, but it's such a patchy postcode lottery. It just seems like such an irritating way to do it, to just kind of give... There's an exiting prostitution scheme, for example, in Norfolk. Now, I don't... pretend I'm perhaps listeners in Norfolk could write in and tell us, but I imagine that actually the city centres, really busy city centres, are more of a place where you would be able to do
and around
that.
Airports. So actually, is there a weird airport in Norfolk that everyone always forgets?
There's, because maybe the, like an RAF airport.
Because like the big places in terms of trafficking and drug use are always your like Luton, the area around the City of London, Stansted, etc., etc.
Yeah, it just seemed a little bit odd to me, but I'm sure it's a very worthy project, but I'm not sure it's being allocated on most need per se, rather than trying to kind of make it look like a politically interesting clutch of organisations to pick. Finally, George, which bits of the budget, is there a pasty tax waiting in there? Is something going to unravel in a bad way over the next couple of days?
Not that I can see, no, not in that, apart from, with the exception possibly of the tampon issue you mentioned. I think, and that's quite deliberate actually, so the EU referendum is obviously less than 100 days away. David Cameron made it clear to George Osborne in advance, I don't want any budget nasties. Of course, at this point in the parliament, chancellors are normally doing quite unpopular things to raise revenue, and then they've got a few years to recover before a general election. But because of the proximity of the referendum, this in some ways was a pre-election budget. Although I think, you know, the sugar tax is quite a risky move. It's got attracted some negative headlines. It can be spun as a tax on the poor. So it will be interesting to see where that debate goes. But I think the biggest risk for Osborne is undoubtedly missing his targets. From a point of principle, he does argue that Britain needs to build up a surplus now because there is the real possibility of a crash or recession in the near future. But the political cost, I think it will be fairly minor because Labour doesn't believe he should have this rule to begin with. He's missed, you know, the fact that he's still Chancellor, having failed to eliminate the deficit as promised in 2010, shows that actually he can be intensely relaxed about missing his targets. And there's very little price to pay. It would harm his credibility on the Tory side, though, which does matter in terms of the leadership contest. I think were Osborne to be on track to achieve that surplus at the point he launched his leadership campaign to take over from David Cameron, it would be a strong message he could send to Tory activists, you trust me to get the country back into the black. Although, if we're talking 2019, they may say, well, you know, you've been saying this since 2010. How much longer are we going to have to wait? Can we really?
In 2019, we're going to be running a £10 billion surplus after the previous year having run what is like a £30 billion deficit. Yeah, but I definitely believe that will happen, George. I you know what? I feel it. I don't know where it'll be. Universal credit will probably save all that money. Stephen, is there a landmine ahead, do you think?
I think the personal independence payments are going to be a running sore. I think that they, yes, the number of people they affect is very small. They're not a significant voting block, but there are definitely more than six Conservative MPs for whom it hits against their sense of themselves and what they believe the Conservative Party is about, and obviously they only have a majority of 12.
I think also they, having Esther McVeigh having been seen as the face of so many of them in the last Parliament, did really hurt her in the Wirral where she lost her seat.
I think it does have a kind of electoral halitosis for for them, you know, among a wider group of people. And my instinct is it will become like the tax credits row. It will drain energy, it will make them unpopular, and they will have to U-turn. And I'm not convinced Osborne's leadership ambitions can survive another unforced error and another climb down.
Well, on that bombshell, this is the end of our special budget edition of the podcast. Thank you very much to George Eaton and Stephen Bush, and I'm Helen Lewis.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And welcome to You Asked Us, the part of the podcast where we take questions from all of you.
Although I would point out that we have had a bumper, essentially, that whole part of the budget when was You Ask Us. So if we answered your question, you know, that's good. If we didn't, then you can always still tweet us at Stephen KB and at Helen Lewis. But tell us, what's the one question that we haven't got to yet?
Can local elections survive the amount of local authorities survive the amount of devolution they are being subjected to?
I think it's a really interesting question because it is one of the Osborne's favourite things that he will kind of go, Devo Mank, you know, in when he wants to try and distract from other stuff. There was some really interesting stuff about like the having a mayor of East Anglia, although I thought he almost said East Anglia in a sort of tribute to Jade from Big Brother. But the thing about
peace
that,
be upon her.
Yeah, the thing I didn't really understand about that is that some of the places with elected mayors, it's worked out really well and they love them. But most of the places did reject them when they were offered the chance. And, you know, in fact, I'm going to say, I can't remember the places that elected Hengist the monkey, their football mascot.
Hartlepool,
three times. So I think that was a fairly kind of comprehensive rejection of the idea there.
I mean, I think the problem... So the advantage with elected mayors is that they are on the whole better for cities. They're a lot, you know, one, because you have a figure who can go around winning investment. The difficulty is whether or not you have a demos for the area in particular. So I think it works very well in Manchester because people think of themselves as being from Manchester.
Or in London, it feels like a unit of governance that is an obvious size, and actually having some coherence of that makes sense. You know, if you Manchester, you want a Manchester-wide tram policy. You know, you want an integrated transport policy that works across that whole urban area.
Because the difficulty is sometimes devolution that makes sense economically doesn't really fit where people are socially. So what would be the number one thing which would improve the economic prospects of people living in the north of Wales? A direct link between Chester and the north. However, for a lot of people in the north of Wales, and indeed a lot of people in Chester, they feel it's a fairly hard border. And trying to persuade people that actually some shared devolution there would work is kind of like getting blood from a stone.
Well, particularly when you've got a devolved authority already to Wales, so the schools and things like that and healthcare are already devolved in a different direction. You do end up with a kind of weird patchwork. Yeah. The problem is for me that the devolution, I think, is a facet of the way that perhaps charities are used. And I talked about this at Christmas, that what you do is you offload your local authority services to tender process with charities. Then when it's not enough money to do the service properly, you go, these people are rubbish at providing the service, let's find another one, and it's not your fault. And I worry that a lot of this devolution is a way of devolving things, hard decisions, to local councils and then saying it's not our fault. So there was all this talk about business rates yesterday, and supposedly that was going to be something that was being partially handed over to a lot of local authorities, but now actually it's been turned out that there's been a unilateral cut from central government.
Yeah, I mean, it's in 2009, one Conservative said to Polly Tilmer, I think, we'll devolve the axe. And that has always been a large chunk of their plan, to pass down responsible for implementing the cuts onto councils, who now legally have to have balanced budgets. And exactly as you said in your column, to pass the blame onto these outsourcers and to these groups. However, I think local government will survive for the same reason that the government will survive, and people will, you know, people are resilient. It will be catastrophic for many people, but the institutions will endure.
Well, that's our slightly bleak answer. It will survive, but in a slightly impoverished and strange jigsaw patterned shape. So thank you for asking.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.